From never been worse to what exactly? Today on The World. After a summit with Russia's Vladimir Putin, President Trump says the meeting was deeply productive.
Our relationship has never been worse than it is now. However, that changed as of about 4 hours ago.
What hasn't changed is Putin's denial that Russia meddled in the U.S. election. And Trump shocked a lot of people today by taking Putin's word for it.
There are very good reasons for the United States and the Russians to get along. But the question is, at what cost?
Reaction to the Trump-Putin summit in Helsinki and much more coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Glad to have you with us today. You know, of all the places in the world we could begin the show today, there's really one clear choice, Finland, which is where in Helsinki, President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin held their historic summit.
Our relationship has never been worse than it is now. However, that changed as of about 4 hours ago. I really believe that. Nothing would be easier politically than to refuse to meet, to refuse to engage, but that would not accomplish anything.
The two leaders spoke about nuclear arms control, energy markets, and working together in Syria. The 45-minute press conference was really overshadowed by one question, though, one word, in fact, collusion. The president repeatedly stressed that there was no collusion between his 2016 presidential campaign and Russia. Here's Vladimir Putin's take.
Once again, President Trump mentioned the issue of Russia's so-called interference in the American elections. And I had to reiterate things I have said several times, including during our personal contact, that the Russian state has never interfered and is not going to interfere in internal American affairs, including the election process. If such things arise, we are ready to analyze them together.
Then the truly remarkable happened. The U.S. president took the Russian president's word over that of his own government. On Friday, the Department of Justice had charged 12 Russian military intelligence agents with hacking the presidential campaign of Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton. Trump said Putin's response had been clear.
I have great confidence in my intelligence people, but I will tell you that President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today. And what he did is an incredible offer. He offered to have the people working on the case come and work with their investigators with respect to the 12 people. I think that's an incredible offer.
On the line with me from London is Karen von Hippel. She's a former counterterrorism advisor at the U.S. State Department. She's now the director of the Royal United Services Institute, a think tank in London. So what do you make of that moment when the president of the United States seems to put more trust in Vladimir Putin than his own American intelligence agencies?
Well, it's not the first time that he has thrown the intelligence community under the bus. It's incredibly shocking, and I don't know how the intelligence community leaders will respond to this, if anybody will resign or not. Including his ambassador in Russia. I mean, it is pretty shocking, this whole experience, but it's not surprising either.
I mean, it's not the first time Trump has spoken this way, but it's certainly the first time he's done so in front of the person that the American intelligence services are basically saying aided and abetted this hacking of the 2016 election. I mean, there are some critics, and they seem to be coming from all political stripes, though noticeably absent Republican lawmakers currently serving. Some are saying this is treason. Some say this is truly the end to the rules-based order following the Second World War. I mean, how do you see the gravity of today's moment?
It's so hard to know. I mean, Trump keeps doing these quite extraordinary things, and sometimes you feel inured to it all. But on the other hand, after the last few weeks where he was criticizing U.S. allies such as UK, the Canadians, the French, and others, countries that have sent their troops to fight and actually die alongside U.S. soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, when he criticizes those sacrifices and those allies. And then he praises Russia at a time like this when Russia is interfering pretty much everywhere in the Balkans and the Baltics, throughout Europe, obviously in the U.S. elections, in Syria, where they're responsible for killing civilians. I mean, it just really is, it's just mind-blowing, basically. It's hard to know really how to respond to it.
Do you see the president's comments today as a sea change, even though he's alluded to these things before?
No, I mean, I think it's entirely consistent with what he has said so far about Putin. For whatever reason, he is afraid to criticize Putin, and none of us know if Putin has anything on him or if he just really admires him because he is a strong man. It's just really hard to say. Obviously, there are very good reasons for the United States and the Russians to get along, but the question is, at what cost?
I mean, astounding as it was, the news conference between Trump and Putin was just part of this summit. What about the private meeting they held beforehand? How concerned are you that whatever was discussed in private for some 90 plus minutes between Trump and Putin was off the record?
Yeah, I mean, the surprising thing I think about this particular meeting was that there was no agenda and that he did not appear to have much prep himself for the meeting. He spent the weekend playing golf in Scotland, as we all know, instead of preparing for this meeting. Any other president would have grounded themselves in all the arguments about the various issues that might have come up, whether it would be NATO, Syria, or the U.S. elections. And it does not appear to be the case that Trump bothered with any of that.
I think a lot of people see today's press conference as confirmation that we are indeed in a new world. I'm just wondering from you, Karen, do you think this new world is a more dangerous one?
Well, it's very concerning when the U.S. pulls back from its normal leadership role, the leadership role that we've all come to expect since the end of the Second World War. It's not clear to me which other countries are going to come together to try to provide that leadership, whether Europe, Canada, and others can do it without the U.S. And if not, what do we end up with? We end up with this situation where leadership goes to the highest bidder, depending where you are. So it could be China, in some places Russia, in other places Iran, in other places. It's not going to make for a stable international order, that's for sure. And it's deeply concerning. I do think some U.S. allies are potentially going to play the long game. They must be thinking, well, look, he won't be around forever. Let's do what we can to keep it all together around the edges and then reinvigorate this when he's gone. But who knows what the world will look like by the time Trump is gone.
Fiona Hill is an old hand on Russia. She's pretty grounded in reality, according to most of her colleagues, when it comes to Russia policy. Do you think that maybe Fiona Hill has some long game going on here that we don't know about?
Look, the reality is there are some very good advisors working for Trump, and he has some very smart members of the cabinet. The issue is he doesn't, you know, it's not clear who he listens to, even his senior cabinet members. He often disagrees with them in public, and so it's just really hard to say who has influence on him and how they are influencing him. I mean, John Bolton should be very strongly against what Russia is doing.
The national security advisor. Yeah.
Right. And it's not clear to me that he listens to anybody. I mean, he has extraordinary confidence in his own abilities and his own wisdom and his own judgment. And I don't think many other people have the same type of confidence that he does.
You know, even commentators and anchors at the usually loyal to Trump Fox News are critical of this moment. What do you think this means for Trump's base? I mean, I know you're there in London, but can they continue to back him if their proxies to Trump continue to criticize this alliance with Putin?
You would think that criticism of the entire U.S. intelligence community, the support of whatever Putin is saying, should be the final straw. But it's really hard to say. They just seem to support him no matter what he does.
Karen von Hippel, formerly with the U.S. State Department, now director of the Royal United Services Institute in London. Thanks very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
In his remarks in Finland today, President Trump congratulated Russia on hosting a great World Cup. The soccer tournament went off largely without a hitch until yesterday, the last day of the month-long event. That's when four members of the protest collective Pussy Riot charged the field dressed as police officers. The group released a statement on Twitter calling for Russia to release political prisoners. They also cited the Russian poet and artist Dmitry Prigov, to which I say, who? Anyway, I spoke with the writer and former editor-in-chief of Moscow GQ, Michael Idov. He said at first he was put off by the Pussy Riot action.
I'm generally a fan of Pussy Riot, and I consider them a very important voice. But I honestly thought that the whole thrust of the World Cup was that it wasn't really Putin's triumph. It was actually something that belonged to the Russian people, because despite the propaganda, despite a warlike stance that Russia has assumed the last few years, the Russian people have proven to be very hospitable and quite nice, and everyone seems to have taken notice of that. So I felt in the moment that kind of repositioning the World Cup as Putin's event actually did a disservice to the Russian people.
But then after they were arrested, and there was a video of the arrest, you changed your mind on Twitter about what you saw. Why?
Correct. Once I saw the video of them getting arrested, and the cop on tape saying, oh, I wish it were 1937 right now, which meant, you know, the height of the Stalin's purges, I think semi-accidentally that is the takeaway from this action, you know. Basically, to get a cop on tape pining for the Stalin-era purges, pining for the power to shoot protesters on sight, I mean, that is what everyone will remember, I think, from this action. And getting arrested is sometimes an integral part of protest art, and we have to remember that. So I couldn't really judge them correctly until I saw the arrest tape.
So then you felt it was time to take a stand for freedom of speech.
Absolutely.
What do you think it says that the World Cup broadcast, because I was watching this live and I saw basically a split second of something, some shape, white shape being dragged off the field. I didn't even know what it was. What do you think it says that we weren't actually able to see what was going on?
Well, that's how Pussy Riot operate. You have to remember that the famous action at the Church of Christ the Savior that landed two of them in prison for 2 years also lasted about 35, 40 seconds. The moment was then stretched out through being padded with other video and being shot by different cameras and through editing. So for Pussy Riot, the documentation, you know, being shot from different angles and editing that together is more important than what happened in the moment.
So tell us about Dmitry Prigov. This is this Russian poet and artist no longer alive that Pussy Riot cited.
Yeah, the action was somewhat cleverly pegged to his anniversary. And he's a poet of the so-called Moscow conceptualist school that started out in the Brezhnev era. And he wrote this kind of childlike absurdist poetry that managed to kind of illuminate some elemental truths about the Soviet and then after that Russian life. And one of them was the cycle of poems about the so-called policeman, the heavenly policeman that Pussy Riot were referring to.
I mean, the heavenly policeman idea, if I may, it's kind of the embodiment of the perfect authority figure.
Something like that, although in Prigov's retelling, the policeman is also kind of a holy fool, another important Russian archetype. But Pussy Riot, I think, wanted to draw attention to the real earthly police, as they put it, which is, you know, lately has been just a long laundry list of abuses of power.
I mean, in a country like Russia that isn't democratic, the people in Pussy Riot, when they take part in these art protests, what do they want exactly? And what are they aiming for when they do things like this?
Oh, that's the question, because different dissenters want different things. And Pussy Riot are incredibly adept at sort of steering global conversation and media conversation toward the right issues, which is what they're doing now through us discussing this. And I think that alone has definite value.
That's writer Michael Idov on Pussy Riot's protest at the World Cup final. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. 4-2, that was the score in France's victory over Croatia at the Men's World Cup yesterday, bringing France its second title. Two of the French goals in the final of the Men's World Cup were unusual. One of them came off a Croatian player's head. Another came from a disputed penalty call after a video replay. The other two French goals, though, were spectacular. And the win turned France into party central. The win had special meaning for France's immigrant communities, many of them in housing projects in city outskirts or banlieue. 17 out of the 23 players on the French squad are either immigrants or the children of immigrants, at a time when immigrants have been blamed for many things in France. Rimsara Alouan has been celebrating. She's a researcher in comparative law at the University of Toulouse, which is where she was watching the game.
What I saw are literally people screaming everywhere, people from different backgrounds getting together to celebrate France and our national team. It was amazing, even in the banlieue, you know, the poorest suburbs of French big cities, you saw the French flag everywhere. So it was so rejuvenating and refreshing to go outside to celebrate a victory.
Can you imagine this happening, that kind of, you know, feel-good moment for all people of all backgrounds and religions and nationalities? Could that happen for any other kind of event?
Football is very unique. It's a popular game, especially for kids and people in the banlieue. You know, the banlieue are vilified, both in France, but also abroad. In France, the banlieue are called the Lost Territories of the Republic. Marine Le Pen mentioned last May during the presidential election campaign that the banlieue was a sign of the decline of France. And in America, on Fox News, it was reported that the banlieue were no-go zones where people wanted to start a civil war in France. So, you know, we forget that humans live in the banlieue, French people live in the banlieue. We only remember the talents of kids living in those poor area every 4 years.
Yeah,
Kylian Mbappé is from the Zinedine Zidane is a kid of the banlieue.
Well,
so,
let me ask you about that, yeah. Because, I mean, the soccer team, a lot has been made about France's men's national team, about being so diverse, with 17 out of the 23 players, either immigrants or children of immigrants. The star of the last World Cup victory 20 years ago, Zinedine Zidane, was also from a banlieue, as you say.
What difference
does a generation make? Because there's still racism in France. In fact, Marine Le Pen, one of your presidential candidates last year, was proud of her racism.
Oh, yes. Let me tell you. Remember in 1998, the generation Black Blanc Beurre, you know, black, white, and people of North African background. We celebrated this diversity. But, you know, in 2002, we had Jean-Marie Le Pen versus Jacques Chirac in the election. So clearly it did not erase racism. Same thing for this World Cup. I mean, this team is far more diverse. Of course, it will not erase racism. It's still here. But we need this reminder from time to time. This kind of event allows us for one moment, for maybe 2 days, to gather together as a diverse nation, because this is France today.
So how long can this moment last where Pogba and Mbappe roll off the tongue as easily as Crepe Suzette?
I hope it will last. I mean, maybe that's me being too optimistic. I just hope that we will consider this player real French. They prove their Frenchness, right? And they're trying hard to prove it. But they need to be considered regardless if they win or not as well.
Rimsara Alouan, a researcher in law at the University of Toulouse. Good to have you with us, as always. Congratulations on your nation's win.
Thank you so much. Merci. Allez les Bleus.
From one story of soccer triumph to another soccer story of a very different kind. For 2 weeks, people across the globe were captivated by a boys' soccer team trapped in a cave in Thailand. 12 boys and a coach. As you no doubt have heard, the boys and their coach are now safe and recovering. But since the rescue effort, the 25-year-old coach Ekapong Chantawong has been the focus of some controversy. We want to check in with the world's Patrick Nguyen in Thailand to find out more about who Chantawong is and what's going on. So Patrick, who is Ekapong Chantawong? What's his background?
Ekapong Chantawong is now known on a first-name basis to the entire country because this is a huge story in Thailand. And everyone just calls him Coach Ek. He's from the northern part of Thailand next to the border with Myanmar. Very rural area, 25 years old. He was orphaned at the age of 10, used to be a monk. He has not had the easiest life. And so people started putting the pieces together, finding out more about his biography. As this was happening, I noticed in Western media, which has been fixated on him, you would hear questions about, well, he's 25 years old, he's an adult, might he be prosecuted for being complicit in leading the boys into this cave? Well, in Thailand, the image of Coach Ek has gone the exact opposite direction. He is now treated as this saintly figure.
How do you explain that division between the perception of people in Thailand who seem to regard him as a hero and talk about him on a first-name basis and the Western media who are kind of digging deeply into who he is and what harm he might have done to these boys?
I think in Thailand, these boys from the rural area of the north in the mountains, they're outdoor kids. This is more of a life that you would see children having in, say, the 1970s or 80s. And then you see in the United States around the 90s, you start getting the helicopter parenting where kids don't really go outside and play in the mud. So I think there's a schism there with American parents saying, why did you even let all of these boys out of your sight in the first place? Shouldn't some adult have been there supervising them? Well, in Thailand, it just doesn't fly like that.
To turn this into kind of a division about attitudes around parenting seems to miss the point that, you know, this was an emergency. He was doing what he could. I mean, that's why I would say the Thai nation sees him as a hero.
Well, yeah, and let's just recount some of the things that are swirling around Thai language social media. These cartoons of Coach Ek, where he's in this red superhero cape with a Buddhist amulet, and he's got little speech bubbles coming out that say, I'm not hungry. You can have my snacks, guys. Let's meditate. This is how it's being seen in Thailand. It is, you know, to be able to meditate in that cave and to be able to not focus on the regrets of the past or the despair of the future and just to be in the present, that's a very powerful skill. So when the Thai public found out about this, all the Thai Buddhist aunties and uncles, they just eat this stuff up because this is what they've been telling their kids to do all their lives. This is why you should meditate. Look how powerful this gift is. So this stuff plays very, very well in a strongly Buddhist nation like Thailand.
He's a 25-year-old soccer coach. He's not a meteorologist. But should he have known that during the monsoon season, rains are unpredictable but common and the cave could flood?
Okay, so I actually went and looked at what the sign said in Thai.
Yeah.
And it says, warning, don't go in without permission. The rains get really heavy from July to November. Well, they went in early June. So you could see them kind of shrugging it off and, okay, let's go in anyway. We're not going to be very long. I think that this was very much a horrible turn of luck. And I think that's how most people seem to be seeing it when I take the temperature on social media here in Thailand.
We'll be watching that story. It does sound like, though, the lift of optimism that this very happy ending to this cave entrapment story lasts a lot longer in Thailand than outside of Thailand. The World's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. Some immigrant families once separated at the border are now reunited, but facing a wrenching decision.
In 1 week, families have to decide, go back with our kids, or should we think about finding them a way to remain in the United States, which would lead ultimately to separation again.
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. More than 2,000 children are still waiting to see their parents. Children separated from their families while trying to cross into the U.S. at the southern border with Mexico. For those who have been reunited, their story got a bit more complicated today. This afternoon, a federal court temporarily halted deportations of reunited families. We've been doing regular check-ins on the immigration situation with The World's Monica Campbell. Monica heads up our Global Nation desk. So update us on the latest, Monica. Is this good news for these reunited families or just more uncertainty?
It could be considered good news. They have a week after being reunited with their children. The parents now have a week to perhaps consult with lawyers or their own families to decide what's best for themselves and for their children. But these are going to be wrenching decisions because in 1 week, families' parents have to decide, is it better for us to go back to the country that we fled with our kids? Or should we think about finding them a way to remain in the United States, which would lead ultimately to separation again? These are wrenching choices, but the idea behind the judge's decision was that there was concern enough about just rapidly in mass deporting all of these families as soon as they were reunited without any ability for parents just to stop and think for a little bit about what's next. And that was enough for the judge to say, let's put a 1 week pause on this and let's see what can happen next.
And what about expectations that the federal government will be able to meet the July 26th deadline to reunite families? I mean, just last week, the Trump administration missed a deadline to reunite all children under the age of five with their families.
It's going really slowly. The government is struggling. They've only reunited about 60 children. They still have more than 2,500 to reunite by the end of this month. The expectations are really low that they're going to meet this deadline. The government has asked for more time. The judge has said, you don't get more time. You need to do this. You need to do this fast. It's all hands on deck. Even still, the expectations are pretty low that the government will be able to do this. They've lost track of children. They've lost track of children and their parents. And it'll be interesting to see if they can really bring all of these agencies, government agencies together that are involved in this story to coordinate reunifications in this short amount of time.
And what about the families still fleeing domestic abuse and gang violence in Central America to seek asylum here in the U.S.? What's happening to them right now at the border?
Right now, there is new guidance in effect for people who interview asylum seekers, kind of the first pass that's called a credible fear interview. And there's new guidance from the Trump administration that makes it tougher for people to seek asylum for certain reasons, specifically gang-related violence and domestic violence. And as we know, a lot of people fleeing Central America are claiming that they're leaving because of gang-related violence and domestic violence. So the bar is higher for them. And I've talked to a number of lawyers and immigration lawyers and advocates about the efforts to try and educate people along the way before they reach the U.S. border.
Monica Campbell with the World's Global Nation Desk. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
As the Trump administration struggles to meet court-ordered deadlines to reunite parents and children separated at the southern border, one option is looming: detaining families together. Immigration authorities currently do that at three facilities around the country. The oldest one is in Pennsylvania, some 65 miles outside of Philadelphia. It's called the Berks County Residential Center. It's run by Berks County under contract with the federal government. Our Global Nation contributor, Valeria Fernandez, has been reporting on the center for several years now. So there was news over the weekend, Valeria, a protest at Berks.
Shut down Berks! Shut down Berks!
So let's start there. Why the calls to shut it down?
Well, I mean, this has been ongoing for the last few years. There is the Shut Down Berks Coalition that was founded in 2015. And the pressure now is increasing because of how this issue is in the forefront due to family separation. There is a concern from activists that more families are going to be sent to the center. Right now they have about 56 individuals there, but the center has a capacity for 96. And they want to increase the pressure on local officials to close the center in the event that the Trump administration is considering sending more people.
There are some serious allegations being leveled at Berks County Residential Center. What are they?
Well, we're talking about there was a documented case of institutional rape that impacted a 19-year-old woman from Honduras. They've documented instances of medical negligence. And, you know, there's a number of other complaints coming from the mothers that spend as much as 660 days in detention when there's been a court order in a case called Flores for quite a long time that says that children cannot be held in detention for more than 20 days.
Mm. So as to those allegations, including institutional rape and child negligence against Berks, this is what County Commissioner Christian Linebeck had to say recently.
When I hear people say that we are somehow harming children, hurting families, nothing could be further from the truth. They are well cared for at that facility.
So give us a little background on Berks, because recently we've been dealing with a spate of families that have been separated. The families at Berks, they remain together. How do the families that are there, how do they end up there?
The practice of family detention started under the Obama administration, and these are families mostly from Honduras, Salvador, Guatemala, Central America, but they can also be from European countries and the Middle East, that are coming to the United States seeking asylum. And they're not necessarily entering the country illegally, but these families are being sent to detention as an alternative because back when, under the Obama administration, they said that they couldn't set them free because they were a flight risk. So instead of using monitoring devices, they will keep the families detained in these facilities because of that concern.
So Berks is called a residential center. You've been using the words detained and detention center. So technically, what is it? Like, can people leave the facility freely, or are they forced to stay there? In other words, is it a detention center?
That is at the heart of the issue with this facility. For the families, this is a prison, and that's how they express it, but for the state of Pennsylvania, for the county, and for immigration authorities, this is a non-secure facility. If this were considered a secure facility by the state, then the families will have to be released, because there's a state law that says you can have children in a prison-like facility that haven't been charged with any kind of a crime by a judge. And so that is at the heart of the issue. But if you go to the facility, and I was there a few years ago, the families are not allowed to leave. And we have documentation from immigration officials saying in court that if they were to leave, they'll be arrested and they'll be treated as fugitives.
And as far as you know, in 2018, that's still the case.
Yes, that's still the case, because we were in touch with the state, and their interpretation of the law is that this is not a secure facility.
So as the Trump administration considers its options when it comes to detaining families, do you think we're going to see more people ending up in facilities like the one in Berks County? And as long as they're together, do you think they'll face criticism?
They are facing criticism right now, because the concern is that the Trump administration would resume the practice that started with Obama. And there are other alternatives to detention that immigration attorneys and human rights advocates are pushing for.
Like what?
You know, for example, and not all of them agree with this, but some of them, they use monitoring devices like ankle bracelets. They could be released to community programs. So there's all these options that have been used in the past that these advocates believe would be better alternatives than housing the families for an undetermined amount of time in facilities that, for them, are like prisons.
Reporter Valeria Fernandez. There's a lot more to the story we couldn't get to in this conversation with Valeria, but you can read her full story about the Berks Center on our website. That's PRI.org. Let's turn now to Nicaragua. Protesters there have been demanding President Daniel Ortega resign. Ortega is a name many of you probably know. He rose to international prominence in the 1980s as the leader of the leftist Sandinistas, was a thorn in the side of President Ronald Reagan and others. And since the 80s, Ortega has been in and out of Nicaragua's leadership. But now many Nicaraguans have had enough of Ortega, and this weekend protests against him turned deadly again. After 2 months of protests at the main university in Managua, pro-government militias attacked some of the students. They had sought refuge in a church on campus, where they were trapped in the ensuing gunfire, along with some priests and journalists. At least two students were killed. Washington Post reporter Joshua Partlow was at the church.
We drove to the area of this church, which had become a refuge area for the wounded and for the students who were pushed back from their barricades. So I was doing interviews there for maybe an hour, at which point the paramilitaries appeared essentially behind us and cut off the exit from the church. And then we were all stuck inside.
Yeah. Describe some of the tense drama that unfolded while you were in there. Were there students around you that died?
When I was there, there were three or four seriously wounded students. Initially, when I got there, they had the wounded out in the courtyard and on desks. When the shooting got pretty close, everyone rushed inside and carried the wounded in there and laid them on the floor. There was one 18-year-old medical student who was shot through the leg and had broken her femur and looked like she was in extreme pain, and it was splinted with basically cardboard and sticks and tape. There was another young man, another student who had part of his foot shot off that came in. After nightfall, it became a little bit more intense and people were shooting at the actual church, and so everyone turned off the lights. People were trying to be quiet. They were trying to, you know, a lot of people had cell phones and were communicating with the outside world. The priest was going on the radio and asking for help. From what I was told when I was in there, that there were several ambulances waiting to get in, but they were blocked for several hours.
Did the students you spoke with, did they assume they'd be safe from the paramilitaries inside a church?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was part of the reason why they had initially gone there and taken their wounded there, was they thought that was a safe space and it wouldn't be attacked.
Opponents to Ortega have been protesting his government for months now. How does this event in this church on the campus of this University of Managua, how does this fit in to the larger picture of what's going on in Nicaragua?
In some ways, it's remarkable how often this kind of thing is happening in Nicaragua. I mean, even yesterday, the day after what happened in the church, a similar episode played out in a town called Masaya, and the paramilitaries blocked off roads into certain neighborhoods. There was hours of gunfire, at least 10 people dead. The government of President Ortega has been intent on breaking these protests and reasserting control. And I mean, it has the flavor of a conflict that could be moving toward a civil war type situation.
I mean, I got to say, such episodes may be happening with alarming frequency in Nicaragua, but not with an American reporter bearing minute by minute witness to it. I mean, it sounds like you're still processing what you went through. I'm also wondering, what did you better understand about the Ortega government and what's at stake for the Ortega government while you were holed up with these students in that church?
I mean, I think one of the things that becomes very clear is that the Ortega government has said that these paramilitary forces don't exist. That's a blatant lie. I mean, they're not in hiding in any sense. They're quite visible. I've saw dozens of them.
And do you know if they're taking orders from Ortega, or are they acting independently?
I mean, that's a big question. It hasn't been proven that they're taking orders from Ortega, but you see them driving and traveling in conjunction with the police. When I left the church on Friday night, we crossed police lines, uniformed police, and the paramilitaries were essentially working right in front of them freely. So I have to assume that they are working in coordination with the security forces.
I mean, Joshua, you just raised a specter of possible civil war in Nicaragua. I mean, what would make the difference between an end to these protests and some peaceful conclusion to these things getting bigger?
Well, I think that what a lot of the protesters are asking for are early elections. Ortega's been in power for, this is his fourth term. So I think that's been a pretty clear demand from the student protesters and others that he step down. He has refused to do that, and he has refused to have early elections. That's why I say this conflict seems like it could intensify. I mean, both because of the violence and the death toll has been rising quite rapidly, but also because he shows no sign of making concessions or backing down.
Washington Post reporter Joshua Partlow, who is now out of Nicaragua, speaking with us from Mexico City. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Maybe you've heard a term the military uses to describe climate change. They call it a threat multiplier. It can make existing stresses and challenges worse, sometimes a lot worse. Well, the idea goes way beyond military threats. Climate change can multiply the challenges for all kinds of vulnerable populations, and it's expected to hit people living with disabilities especially hard. Jason Strother got a preview of that future up close on a trip to Tacloban in the Philippines when he met with survivors of the 2013 typhoon Yolanda.
Basita De La Rosa and her family run a small furniture-making business outside their home in Tacloban. Their house, of concrete and corrugated steel, overlooks Anibang Bay. She says people in this part of the Philippines are used to typhoons, but no one was prepared for Yolanda's intensity.
Our house was badly damaged. The roof blew off and rain was pouring in. My husband went up to the second floor to protect the kids, but I could only stay on the ground floor and sit in my wheelchair.
De La Rosa is 71 and hasn't been able to walk for nearly three decades because of a car accident. As Yolanda bore down on Tacloban, a storm surge sent the bay rushing into De La Rosa's house.
How high was the water?
With her hands, she shows me how the seawater rose all the way up to her waist. De La Rosa says she just kept praying that she'd survive until the water receded. It might seem obvious that people with a disability would have difficulty escaping a typhoon or a flood, but advocates say it's only going to get worse.
People with disabilities are disproportionately affected by pretty much every aspect of climate change, but relatively ignored in, first of all, literature and then also policy.
Alex Guinness works on climate change issues at the World Institute on Disability. Guinness says climate change puts people with a disability at greater risk, in part because many depend on caregivers, assistive devices, and access to medication, all of which can be disrupted during a weather-related disaster. And as storms become more destructive, more people will acquire a disability.
You're going to see direct injuries from natural disasters, say collapses of buildings.
That's what happened to Lita Estor during Typhoon Yolanda. Estor, who's 50, lives in a squatter village several yards from the Anibong Bay.
Get inside.
When I ask her how she was injured during the storm, she shows me by removing her prosthetic left leg. Estor says her foot was cut when the storm surge flooded her home. The wound became infected, and her leg needed to be amputated below the knee. 4 years after the storm, she's still on a waiting list to be relocated to safer ground. In the Philippines, living with a disability is precarious enough as it is, says Clara Francisco. She heads the Tacloban Persons with Disabilities, or PWD, Federation. I spoke to her outside a busy government office building.
Most of us were not able to go to school. For most PWDs, we're not getting well with our lives.
But climate change magnifies this vulnerability almost a million times over. That's according to Perpy Chung Song at the Manila-based Oscar M. Lopez Center, which studies climate change. For example, she says there may be dozens of different sign languages across the country, and standard Philippine signing isn't always taught at schools for the deaf. And in some lower-income communities, the deaf might not have learned how to read. All of that compounded the difficulty in assisting people with a hearing impairment during Typhoon Yolanda.
Humanitarian workers had the difficulty of communicating to them, to inform them where were the safe places to go, where were the evacuation centers. Right now, there are no established signs in the community in terms of, you know, signs for typhoon or whether it's signal number 1 or 5, storm surge, these kinds of things.
Tiong Song adds there is an effort to create new sign language gestures for terms like these. It's one way to better alert the deaf and minimize potential harm. In Tacloban, everyone tells me that it's just a matter of time before the next big storm hits. Though since Yolanda, some improvements have been made to the city's evacuation system. Now when a storm approaches, megaphone announcements warn the blind and flags are raised to alert the deaf. But PWD Federation leader Clara Francisco says she's still not convinced that the needs of her community are fully understood.
We are less important to them. That is all. That's simple as that. We are less important.
Francisco says that it was only after Typhoon Yolanda that persons with a disability were noticed at all. She hopes that it doesn't take another superstorm to remind authorities that they're still here. For The World, Jason Strother, Tacloban, the Philippines.
We're going to end the show today by going back to the royal wedding in Britain back in May. Remember that? Yeah, how could we forget that feel-good real-life Disney moment? Prince Harry and Meghan Markle tied the knot in a ceremony watched by millions around the globe. Musicians who performed at the wedding got huge exposure. One of them was cellist Sheku Kane Mason. 2 years ago, the BBC selected him their Young Musician of the Year, the first black musician to receive that honor. As Kane Mason told our colleagues at the BBC recently, it wasn't easy for him to choose a career in classical music because there were hardly any black role models.
The main thing is not having people who look like you doing classical music. I think it's very difficult to want to do something where you see no one from your background doing. I think for me, I always had my family and lots of musicians I would admire, but it's very difficult to want to go into classical music if you don't feel it's for you. It's never been something that has stopped me in any way or affected me in any way, but it's something I've always been conscious of. I started playing the piano first because I have an older sister and an older brother who are playing the piano and the violin, so I grew up listening to them practice, and that kind of inspired me to also follow what they were doing. And then I started having violin lessons as well, only for a few months. And then I went to an orchestral concert and got really excited by the sound of the cello. That was when I was 6 years old, and I've been loving the cello ever since.
And now Sheku Kane Mason is the role model for young black kids in Britain who want to play classical music. And if you go by one of his latest singles, he's also broadening the repertoire with his own arrangement for cello of Bob Marley's classic, No Woman, No Cry. Sheku Kane Mason says he heard a lot of Bob Marley growing up. I'm guessing this number lives in his bones. That's our show today. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.